Welcome to Toogie Sidebar, a book club for the professionally online. I'm David.
I'm Gabe, Ursula Gwynn's biggest gooner.
And I'm Cap, and Gabe stole my line this time.
And today we're back again with several random topics. We're doing a Dave, Cap, and Gabe's grab bag.
Yes, it's a group grab bag.
Everybody gets a pinch.
You have to grab before you tug.
So we're doing a bit of a different format. In the interest of favoring our algorithm overlord, we're breaking this episode in a few different shorts for YouTube. We're going to upload it as just one episode on Spotify and Apple, iTunes, whatever, Apple Video, wherever you find it. Please vote us up there. By the way, if you subscribe, please just, you know, click the little 5-star button. Doesn't take but a minute, you know. Yeah, go ahead and remove that pesky ad block while you're at it.
And you're really earning the name Harad, you know. 300 subs and you already got it to your head.
Oh, brothers. We're growing. So yeah, hugely appreciate it if you could do that. And today, you know, we're rather than covering a single book, we have My Confessions Part 2 coming out very soon. But we're doing a couple of topics that are related to the kind of things we do, books, culture, kind of like dissident lit. And before we dive into those, we have an announcement to make. We've officially taken the Peterson route, gentlemen.
You can now give us money. There's a way.
Oh, I thought we were washing our penises.
Never.
I'm currently wearing a 5-piece colored, various colored suit, and I now am the proud, administrator. I need to give you guys admin privileges, but to our subscribe star and Patreon, if you guys, if anyone's interested, we just set those up earlier this week. No expectation. If you enjoy this, we love doing this. We plan to keep doing it. But if you're willing to give us support, we hugely appreciate it. We'll, you know, eventually, once we hit a certain benchmark where our plan is to increase our frequency of uploads, there's an editor who very kindly, one of our guys, offered for a very reasonable price to do some editing for us to get more stuff out. So we're kind of working up to that goal. Every dollar we get is basically just going into the podcast at this point. Yep. Three tiers. Summarize. Do you guys want to recap it, or I can?
Well, there's the little tugger, which is basically kind of like the cut chair option. If you donate like a dollar or more,
we still appreciate you. Yeah, the cuck chair.
Yeah, you get to voyeuristically enjoy from the sidelines while the big tuggers, you know, get their books reviewed. Because if you're a top tugger, you can recommend any book you want, and we'll review it.
Well, if you're a top tugger for 3 months, you can request a book or topic, and we will cover it. It might not be a full episode length, probably going to be a mini-sode, but it definitely could expand, especially considering one of our members' tendency to go off when he's really into something, Gabe.
Yeah, I wonder who that could be.
And the $5, I think you guys are selling short the $5 editorial board member. You become a Toogie editorial board member, you get to vote on upcoming topics we do. So, you know, we're going to occasionally put out polls to decide what we're going to cover next. So it's a really easy way to both support us and get a chance to control what kind of things we cover, have a little bit of creative control on it, and just support your boys. Again, no pressure. If you got bills to pay, please do not sweat this. We will be here. We're here to, you know, serve the cause, support the boys. But anything you're willing to contribute helps really justify our time and energy. So extremely appreciated.
Well, one, is there a difference between occasionally and infrequently, by the way? Is there a substantive difference between those two statements?
Yeah, the implication, I know you're an ESL, but the implication is that infrequently is less frequent than occasionally. Occasionally is probably at least 4 times a year. Infrequently is like twice a year. Also,
we're going to put a poll 4 times a year.
Also, as far as the polls go, it will help us prioritize because we do have a backlog of projects that we are considering or that we want to do.
Yeah.
And you know, it will help us make those decisions on prioritizing, because we can only cover so much in a certain time period.
Literally three magazines in the last 48 hours that we want to cover, and it's like, which, like, and it's just so hard with magazines because short stories. So yeah. Short stories take longer per page than a book, and so it's like, what do we do?
Yeah, and also, and another side note, I love the fact you included the edging as a top tugger. You had to edge for 3 months because y'all know I would make an alt account
and just to edge and sub. Oh my god, you're just gonna do it so that you get to cover one of your terrible suggestions.
Yes, I was going to game the system, so I'm glad you put some anti-game software going to edging requirement.
So eventually, we're also planning on offering early access to anything we produce to subscribers, of course.
And of course, any top tugger, if you donate $100 or more, you will get a 50% discount on my OnlyFans, by the way. We're trying to get into like the art ho dime square market. So I am sadly the Dasha of this group, so I will sexualize myself for views.
You know, of course, he hasn't doxed himself yet, so... you know, it's going to be completely blank for a while.
No. You know what I'm going to do? It's going to be like just from the neck down. Let the face be imagination, you know?
It's so much worse than you can possibly imagine. It's really Lovecraftian pornography that you're producing. It can't be described or perceived directly. Only implied. Only derived from other horrifying information.
Yeah, my body has a very non-Euclidean shape to it.
It's like a half-rotted jack-o'-lantern.
Imagine the smell.
Actually, rotting pumpkin just smells a lot like pumpkin. It's not that bad.
Yeah, actually, yes, smells pretty good. I kind of like the smell of old pumpkin. Yeah, like at the end of October, you kind of get that like kind of sickly sweet. Yeah, it's pretty pleasant. But anyway, thanks for the gold, kind YouTube viewer, if you're so inclined. And we will chill. You know, we'll probably mention this just every episode for about 30 minutes at the start from now on, and hopefully we get a few bucks.
This is what keeps us from trying to sell you overpriced breakfast cereals in boxes that are smaller
than what?
Yeah.
Wait, no, I was just about to do a cutout to Raid Shadow Legends, our little ad sponsor.
No, we didn't have to. No. Because of the kind Subscribestar and Patreon supporters, we don't have to sell our booty holes to Nordman.
Well, you should have told me before I wrote signed the damn contract, motherfucker.
Well, sorry, your booty hole is forfeit. It's good. You can put it. You can put it on your OnlyFans.
Still up for grabs.
We used to have standards. We used to have dignity, man. We used to be punk rock.
We do. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't sell out. I bought in. Anyway. So this week we're covering the latest young adult fantasy fiction from a brown woman. Just what you all tuned in for.
Yes, first female in the pod, actually.
Hey, what the fuck are you talking
about?
No,
it's I was kidding. I was saying we're now sponsored by Simon & Schuster.
We're now sponsored by Simon & Schuster.
We're covering
the hottest new TikTok sensation.
Yeah, we're covering book talk only. It's nothing but bitches reading fantasy about werewolves fucking them. So,
and to be clear, we're rating the girls in the thumbnails, not the books they're covering.
Actually, no joke. That's kind of what our first topic relates to is, the market demand. You know, this is actually kind of serendipitous. The market demand versus the user thing. Because I feel like we serve a hyper-specific niche. We serve a hyper-specific niche within
the Nietzsche
within
niche.
The world. Yes, the Spenglerian Nietzschean Ubermenschian niche. I cannot say that right tonight. Anyway, and so that's why it's so important to support us. But anyway, moving on. So our first topic to cover tonight is a bit of a follow-on to a certain episode we had discussing friend of the show Mark Dawson. Your everyone's friend old Davey here made a certain, what I felt at the time was a throwaway comment, and the throwaway comment was this: it's accepted wisdom within the writing community that putting out about one full-length novel of 60 to 100,000 words per year is a sort of standard, somewhat aggressive pace for writing output.
Source? Can I get a source? Do you have a reference to that? Do you have a source?
Brandon Sanderson's podcast. I said it. So in the writing world of people who write and have no lives, there's a discourse about how many words per day that you put out. And as a loser, I somewhat follow this and listen to what people are saying. And early on, as I was just kind of dabbling into writing as I was trying to adjust after my crypto addiction, gambling addiction, as my outlet of writing, I was like, what's normal to write? And a lot of the things I heard and what I found myself as I got a bit of experience is 500 to 1,000 words per day when you write is like a very... Or within like an hour, 500 to 1,000 words per hour of writing. And typically getting me 2 hours of creative writing a day is pretty normal. And then you kind of get a little bit of worn out in your creative muscles. Obviously, a lot of other things to do rather than just, when I say writing, I'm talking about drafting, throwing words on a page. So that is my context going into making that said statement, which, unbeknownst to me, was perhaps the most provocative statement in the Tookie's Mag history. It wasn't any of the racial epitaphs. It was not any of the various euphemisms for sable that were thrown around.
Well, y'all did get caught for bald shaming. Y'all did bald shame a little bit.
That's true. We did bald shame. And
It's no shame to be bald. It's a shame to fight the acknowledgement of being bald. Just shave it. Just pick it.
Yeah.
Gillette it, even.
Or just keep it short. Yeah. Keep it short and just do this Costanza. But wicking it up with a gel is just not solving the problem.
You're not volumizing. You're just drawing attention to the problem. You look like a pale cactus.
But it does make for a great thumbnail.
It sure does. Likeness rights. Yeah.
Friend of the show, Mark Dawson, in the commentary, someone who was certainly not Mark Dawson. I just want to read just one of the many comments because we got quite a few replies to this video, more than usual for a little old crew like us. I just want to read aloud two specific ones. I'm not going to name the person who was certainly not Mark Dawson, who said that, who said the following: some indie authors publish 12 to 20 books a year. All right, so let's just quick math on that. That's a book or two per month.
What's the capacity of a modern crematorium?
I'm not doing cookie math here. And then the second part is, when pressed, yours truly, David, I said the following: Brandon Sanderson, Stephen King, full-time prolific writers with editors, cover designers, marketing, logistics staff on standby, generally put out 2 to 4 novels a year. King Sanderson, King Sanderson. And my question was, how do you think indie authors are capable of publishing 12 to 20 books a year? For argument's sake, let's say that's 15 books a year. That's a new book published every 24 days. That's more than a book per month. Presumably, they also get freelance support, do background work themselves. How many hours a day, conceivably, could they spend writing each book at that point? And then the follow-on to that, again, I would just love to hear your guys' response to this one comment, not naming the person. The ones I know, lots are ex-military, probably Navy SEALs. That's my speculation, David's speculation. Have excellent self-discipline. Lots dictate. This seems to be the way they write so much. They have editors, etc. I know one author who wrote 29 books in 2023. I won't tell you because you'll probably do a YouTube video dissing them. All right, I'll leave it there. I won't read any more.
So true.
29 books.
Was the commentator, was his name Narc Lawson by any chance? Or was it Dawson Groyper 14?
It's almost. It's almost 2.5 books a month is a lot. I mean, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, they have got to be novellas just in terms of your possible ability to put things out.
This sounds awfully like book publishing denial to me.
It's just. Working full days, doing nothing else, publish 29 books a year, like, okay.
You know, the math doesn't add up. That much glue, you know, the smokestacks, you know, why were they using a wooden door as they published?
Yeah, are these like, Kindle Direct formulaic, you know, banged by an alien books?
That's exactly my point, is like, what defines a book in this situation, right? It's like, what's the length? And some of them are good length. Like, I had another friend of the show, Mark Partlow, commented and said he's written 60 books in 7 years, average of 85K words. Thank you, friend of the show, Rick, for commenting. And, you know, it's just part of it is like, is what defines a book at this point and what defines a writer? Like, that's the huge like qualitative difference in this weird output discourse. So when someone says I'm a writer, I write, how many people are actually writing full time, right? And like, what is the expectation for that? Like, very few people have the luxury of writing full time. Or if you're wealthy enough to have that luxury, you would choose to punish yourself in such a way to try and make a living writing full time fiction.
And a keyword being luxury, because you know they're not making that much money off it.
Mm. And so I guess that's the first category of like defining it. And so I struggle with this topic. And the reason I bring it up is because there's that. And then there's also like the, I don't say quality, but the type of writing. Like, is it pulp? Is it literary? And these are very amorphous terms. And there's a lot of like wiggle room in between. But like, kind of writing are you putting out? I feel like that's a kind of an unspoken part of this. And part of what I find a little stifling about the indie writer community is like, you go in and actually shout out another like unironic friend of the show, David Stewart. He's actually not, he's a guy who I respect, who's a writer. And he has this comment about he went in the indie writing community and, you know, he thought he would find other people who are like creative, looking to write the newest, uniquest, weird new thing. But instead you find like it's the most mechanized, processed, like how do I output 5 of the current trending werewolf romance, now it's vampire, sex slave, now it's this whatever weird niche subgenre, and hit it as hard as possible.
And he wrote a good essay on that called like To the Algorithm Gods, where a lot of these female romance authors, like they choose the best topping trends on the Amazon algorithm.
Oh.
Then they pay Amazon extra.
So perfect example of this. David, your recently published novella Improvidence was for a while in the top 50 colonization fiction books on
like,
Amazon.
Samuel Chamberlain.
But what's on the other things in colonization fiction are all they're all books by either let's see, I'm looking it up right now, Honey Phillips, totally a real name, or Ruby Dixon, also totally a real name, that are all genres that contain all of Ruby's stuff contains the word barbarian. And has a giant hulking man in a who is like blue or purple or green.
Ice Planet yeah, Barbarians lady?
And
that's
then,
her?
Yes, Ice Planet Barbarians. That's correct. She's got about 30 other books about barbarians. Or Honey Phillips, which has a similarly prolific amount of books about how the alien of a series called How the Aliens Were Won, and it's a different lovely lady posing next to a buff alien man who basically just looks like, I mean, it's about as creative as far as aliens go as like Star Trek, where it's just a human with like one extra thing glued on and painted a different color. In some cases, not even that, actually. But yeah, so that's what you were competing with. You were competing with two. I mean, this is not, these are, would not fit my definition of a, you know, quote fingers here, a real book, not a real book. It's just, it's pornography. Like, so,
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, they write pornography. David writes erotica.
Oh my God. Right. Hold on. If I scroll down a little, actually, there's the, I married a blank, from Regine Abel, which is,
can you send me screenshots? By
you
the
just
way?
Look this I up on Amazon in colonization fiction. Just saying, but which I'm sorry, David. Improvidence is no longer ranked. There were probably some very sexually frustrated women who read that and realized that they could not fap to that.
they got jealous. They got jealous of the sexy cloned redheads,
right? I married a Naga and I married a lizard man from the Prime Mating Agency series.
Isn't I Married a Naga, isn't that the biography of Thomas Jefferson, if I remember correctly?
Damn, <Baze. laughs> Leather Apron Club, get in here. Respond to this guy.
More like my brother's weird fetish made people retroactively call me out.
Genetically blame me. I want to just point out,
the grave.
we're not genre snobs here. Like we're like, I feel like we're some of the most omnivorous readers, that like you two guys in particular. Like I always feel like I was kind of a weirdo because I would like read all sorts of stuff, but you guys I feel like are even more read and read more weird stuff than I do. So it's not so much. It's not that we hate pulpy stuff or even erotica. Like, I get it. Women read erotica and that's a thing. It's the formulaicness of it and the apples to oranges comparison of like, you have to be writing this amount without acknowledging like the type of thing that's being written and questioning the value of writing it and then just advertising it heavily. Again, this is a bit of following the whole Dawson, the concern over his methodology that he was advertising and the damage that it causes to the whole writing scene, where you have these people just, they're concerned with the creator side exclusively, and they're not worried about the buyer side and the kind of environment that they're creating, of whether they're actually creating something that's like of value and as valuable as possible to the quote unquote, not the quote unquote, the literal, to the culture. Rather than to their economic short-term value that they get from it. And I just see there's a fundamental mismatch. And this discourse emphasizes it because it's so focused on the writer side. Like, most readers would never stumble across this at all. But you see a lot in writing circles about hitting your word count and getting your output to a certain level. There's a kind of a peer pressure element to it.
I mean, it's also breeding like a really shit kind of reader. I mean, I don't know. This is the good reads. How many books are you going to read this year? Does this count as a book? Right? Like, can I count, you know, proofreading my child's 3-page essay towards my Goodreads? Like, it's why does the quantity of books clearly does not fucking matter. And
listen, I have, you know, my mom did that. Thank you very much.
Great. Great. She's also ghostwriting all of your comments. You've got an earpiece in. You're getting past lines from your madre and your abuela are passing you words.
I am the longhouse.
Yes. Just an avatar of it. But yeah, it's this weird, it's just a fucking stupid metric, right? It might take you a year to, I mean, say you wanted to read Proust, you know, you're not going to read any portion of In Search of Lost Time in the same amount of time as you would read, you know, someone's 50 page How Predator from the Predator was a sexual predator and I liked it. You know, you're not going to read that in the same amount of time. But one counts for my Goodreads, one as one book, and one counts as one book. So obviously I'm just going to read the bullshit. It's a frustrating way to look at things that I can't get behind. And I think it's all very, I think it's a very similar attitude as the get your word count. It doesn't matter how good it is. Just put out some shit.
Well, on that point, on a serious point, I think the reason why it offends us and why we have a distinct revulsion against this kind of thing is that it's profane in a lot of ways. We're agnostic overall, but at the end of the day, for us, literature is sacred. There's an element of something that is sacred. And there is art as fashion, as in a sacred practice. Like these guys who write 10 books a year, 100 books a year, some guys claim a ridiculous amount of books a year, by the by, you know, who openly admit to using ghostwriters. There's something deeply crash and like very petite bourgeois about it. It's purely for ego. It's purely like, well, these guys, they commit so much to making this somewhat successful. It's like the boomer version of dropshipping. If you notice, like, all these guys are over the age of 40, right? While the Zoomers are too busy dropshipping, like, buying shit from Chinese Amazon to sell slightly cheaper on, like, American Amazon. The Boomers, for the sake of ego, like, oh, I wrote 10 books this year. I wrote 20 books this year. They will game the system. And it's like, honestly, it's kind of, you know, it's like the literature version of a tranny, to be honest with you. Like, hey, I'm a real author. I'm a real book. You know, it's like, no, no, you're not. You'll never be a real writer. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, thousands of years of being blessed by the muses have to
episode get to this. Title. Nicely done.
You never
will be, never a, real be a real author. The yeah. Also, yeah. If you have a ghostwriter or you have a writing assistant, you did not write that. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, James Patterson. Sorry, Tom Clancy's fucking Ghost. Like, did not write that. You know? It's like, oh, yeah.
Listen, now the only it's just a guy brand. Got...
It's so stupid.
Yeah. The only guy who got away with that was Shakespeare when he had the Earl of Oxford write all his plays.
There's a, I guess, unless you guys have anything else on it, I guess I'd like to end with a quote that I think kind of frames, this ties into the greater, like the tropification of fiction. I think it's a whole nother topic to cover another time, but it feeds into this marketing pressure on an art form and the way it bends it. I want to read a quote from true friend of the show, Michael Lindsay. His most recent essay, Against Designer Religion, and he has a quote that I especially enjoyed. A little German here for you, Gabe. Gestell, or just, I'm going to say it was Gestell, in framing is what that means, which transforms the stuff of the world into Bestand, the standing reserve, in the eyes of man. The world itself is revealed as this stockpile of resources, where once it was imbued with soul and meaning. Heidegger's key example is the damming of the Rhine, a river so full of sacrality in the mythology of the German people, illustrates the spiritual consequences of this process, perversely in wanting to claw back the material upshots of a lost spiritual condition. I think that applies to fiction in this, and I'll leave that there for now, in this context of in being so perfectly marketed, captured, and sort of a data-driven death of an art form, that it becomes this tropified mess of people applying these mass maximum speed, mass market, multi sort of corporate produced with many people involved to produce a product that no one will remember. In 30 days, it'll hit top 20 in colonization subgenre for pornographic topics, but it doesn't have staying power. And again, fine, nothing against pulp in the least, but just people promoting this as the way to make a living and to produce it. That's my concern. And I have nothing against people that produce and try to make a dollar in by writing books. I think you just need to acknowledge the kind of writing you're doing and the kind of master you're serving with it. And I guess I'll leave it on that slightly salty note.
It's a good note to end on, but I would actually say it's kind of disrespectful to pulp, because you know, pulp does cater to the base desires, right? You know, sex, murder, all these base desires, but they're still done by men. They're still done individually based on the old mm-hmm. school way. Like, you know, you're paid by the letter, so you feel a lot of purple prose, you know, but this is a managerialized version of, it's mass pulp. It's like cocaine pulp, right? It's over-the-counter pulp. You know, if it's very much, you know, here's a little bottle. Here's what we got 1,000 focus groups to approve it. It's approved by the Lord of the Algorithm. You know, so it's pulp. It's the worst kind of pulp. It's the pulp, like, with all the human aspects of pulp retracted away from it. It's like the cat videos.
It's committee pulp. It's like pulp by committee. Yeah. Rather than like Howard, who's some weirdo with erectile dysfunction living in Texas, who lived with his mom, writing insane shit. And sending it in to some guy in Massachusetts or whatever who is publishing it. This is somehow approved by the mass consensus of cat ladies on Goodreads and their overlords.
They gotta flick the bean somehow, my guy.
for once, I'm not going to reference German authors. I'll reference two French authors, you know, Baudrillard and Renard Camus. You know, it's both the simulacrum where we have so much content that it basically generates itself. We've invented the literature version of the self-licking ice cream cone. It's a mix of the simulacrum idea and Renard Camus' idea of Fordism, based on Henry Ford.
Not his first name. Ooh. Albert Camus' first name.
No, I'm not talking about that Camus. I'm talking about Renard Camus, like the dissident author in France.
Oh.
He coined the big replacement.
He sure did. Hey, I was retarded. There we go.
You're a poser.
I've never read him.
You're the white girl in the band t-shirt.
I've never read him. Yeah. Yep. Name three songs.
He just got translated. name three racist Frenchmen. But now the idea of Henry Fordism, where, you know, the idea of every piece is interchangeable, so it makes the, you know, conveyor belt more easy to run. Like, this kind of literature is that in a digital format. It's a self-licking ice cream cone that all it knows how to do is constantly generate itself. Where the author, a lot of these people, you realize a lot of these people are now making AI-generated books. Like, they have ChatGPT just make gibberish and sell it on Amazon. At this point, it literally is just a factory of self-licking ice cream cones.
Mm, that's a great visual. And I think it ties into our next topic perfectly. Yeah. Because I think, I think it's apt.
So, our next topic is... from a speech, classic fantasy and fantasy author, and well, fantasy and sci-fi author Ursula K. Le Guin gave at a commencement of a writer's workshop. And it's called "From Elfland to Poughkeepsie," and in it, she sort of lays out the difference between it. Honestly, this is it's very mold bug esque, like this naming of a concept in a funny way, so that you can continuously point back to it. Elfland, in Le Guin's conception of it, is sort of the world of enchantment. It's, you know, it's not just, say, the generic fantasy setting of elves and dwarves and dragons and wizards. It's the idea of a completely idealized, iconic kind of fictional reality that can be taken seriously in its own right. Okay? Versus Poughkeepsie, which is a nowhere city in upstate New York. It's basically It's basically the average place. It's the real world in the worst sense of that. And her first example of, you know, Elfland is wandering into the wilderness, like a completely untamed world, and marveling at the beauty of nature and the height of the mountains and the depth of the valleys and the mist and the smells and the wildlife, fearing and being moved by it, and loving it. Whereas Poughkeepsie is driving your Winnebago into Yosemite, putting it in the parking lot, and acting as if you have been there in the same way as the people who go to Elfland.
Yeah, and then getting surprised when you meet a firsthand what a Yogi Bear is really like in real life.
Right. So it's the idea of that, I mean, it has a lot of currency among our guys right now, this idea of re-enchantment, right? Of believing that there is, believing that there are greater things, that it's possible to even conceive of greater things that are not merely bureaucratic minutiae and, you know, Aragorn's tax policy, as Drartan Martin most famously noted in opposition to George R.R. Tolkien's idealized world of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, George R.R. Tolkien, the yes, famous co-author.
Drartan Martin Martin. And here's an example. And you know, this speech was delivered before Game of Thrones was ever written. So she said, here's a little excerpt from what I read recently. Whether or not they succeed in the end will depend largely on Kelson's personal ability to manipulate the voting. Can he? Morgan asked, as the two clattered down a half flight of stairs into the garden. I don't know, Alaric, Nigel replied. He's good, damned good, but I just don't know. Besides, you saw the key council lords. With Ralson dead and Bran Corus practically making open accusations, well, it doesn't look good. I could have told you that at Cardosa. At this point, I was interrupted. Ursula K. Le Guin goes on. And the next time I sat down, I happened to pick up a different kind of novel. A real now novel. Naturalistic, politically conscious, relevant, set in Washington, D.C. Here's a sample of the conversation from it between a senator and a lobbyist for pollution control. Whether or not they succeed in the end will depend largely on Kelson's personal ability to manipulate the voting. Can he? Morgan asked as the two clattered down a half flight of stairs into the White House garden. I don't know, Alaric, Nigel replied. He's good, damn good, but I just don't know. Besides, and of course you see where she's going with this, what is the point of... It's not only missing the point of fantasy, you know, of to deal with these types of low concerns, but it's actually almost sacrilege. Like, you're actually doing harm to the reader disenchanting the world.
Right, you're breaking your promise to the reader, because your reader, with fantasy, she even talks about people see fantasy as the escape to, you know, escape from reality to somewhere else. That's why she uses the metaphor of the national parks,
right,
as like a little vacation. Like, oh, nothing, like, you know, it's not too dangerous. You're not like the actual frontiersman who, with an axe and matches, actually go out there to experience the sincere wilderness. Like, modern fantasy is like a very much, it's like a tourist attraction. I mean, it's been tourified. It's been Las Vegas-fied, basically. And, sorry, and what she's talking about here is that basically when you use this crass sense of realism, when you have one of the good examples she uses in the text, and I really enjoyed this essay, by the way, but there's a lot of faults in it I think we'll get to later, but there's this great essay where she basically makes fun of Marvel dialogue, like 50, 60 years before Marvel dialogue was a thing.
Yeah.
Because she criticizes a author because you have an epic fantasy battle, like these fantasy characters.
Are quipping.
But then she wants to... they're quipping and they're using modern like slang in English. It's like, you know, it's the cool thing, like, he's right behind me, isn't he? Like, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They use Marvel quips.
She points out, of course, because Le Guin is, and I don't want to get into the women question here, but Ursula Le Guin is one of the greatest American authors of the 20th century. And I mean, even St. Harold Bloom did say that, she had a place in the canon, which is saying a lot.
Because of Left Hand of Darkness, right?
Left Hand of...
We are women respecters here, dude. Like, let there be no doubt. I'm a huge Ursula Le Guin stan. Like, I went to shout out Ursula Le Guin's Steering the Craft. Great book. If anyone wants to read about writing craft, this is totally in her style, her wheelhouse. Her style is always example led. Like in this essay, there's like five like really specific pulls from the text. Like everything is based on, it's in text example, talking about style. She's so style over like quips or just like bullshit statements. She'll dive right
absolutely
into it.
So, yeah. Style. She says style is not an ingredient. She outright says style is the cake. Right? It's not an ingredient. Yeah. It's style is the book.
I think that's the most important statement in the whole text, actually. Like, I was going to call that out.
I mean, she undermines that point in a little bit.
No,
but,
I don't disagree. Disagree.
Footnote number 3, my friend. We'll get to that later. But in a lot of ways, I'm a Nabokovian. This reminded me very much of Nabokov's lectures on literature. Now, as an American, you notice that her stress on style, she says stress is in dialogue. That's a very American point, by the way. In classical European POV, it's prose that's more stylistic, not necessarily dialogue. The Americans tend to be more dialogue-oriented, and that shows more style. That's the big difference between
them. Oh, I mean, a slightly different but similar criticism is believing that plot is somehow the most important aspect of a book and thinking that you basically have read the book if you've read a plot summary, which is makes me want to Fed post.
I think the only author who like went by that philosophy was Agatha Christie, I think. Was there any author that ironically gave a fuck about plot?
Trope eggs. They're all about it.
Lots of readers.
The people that write the stuff we were just talking about. Yeah, and the people, the readers of it are just, they go by the plot. Like, what is it about? Was it friends to lovers? Is it about, boyfriend kidnaps me or whatever generic trope?
Yeah. But the trope bags, they don't create, though. I was talking about creators. Like, the TV trope people, they literally just, like, jerk off each other and, like, get each other canceled for having wrong opinions on TV tropes and which folder to put it under, right?
Yeah. I agree with your statement about her, though, about... I just want to defend M'lady. I want Wickersheeld M'lady on your accusation that she was talking about just dialogue, because her samples are very prose heavy. Like, the first one is dialogue, but the others, I believe, are pretty much prose.
I wasn't criticizing her example. She said, prose is the most obvious way of seeing style. It was mostly a nitpick. It was a nitpick from me. Just noticing the differences. Because, again, this essay, it reminds me of my idol, Nabokov, very much. Because he also, like, the style is everything in a novel, right? The literature is a game, right? Literature is a way of, it's not crass reality, right? Because at the end of the day, it is, you're playing pretend with yourself, your imagination, with your very idea of language. You know, the limits of your world is the limits of your language, right? So you're making this toy out of ornate glass, basically, like a kaleidoscope. And you have to basically, it's like kayfabe in a wrestling. You have to layer on a lie, truth, and lie again. Have it be a beautiful lie. Have it be seductive. It's an enchantment. The key word being is an enchantment, right? It's like everyone knows magic tricks are fake, but they go to experience it because they want to see how well it is pulled off. They want to be let permission to trick themselves, basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean they're looking for enchantment.
Yeah, and that's what fantasy, that's the idea of fantasy. Like, for example, with Lord of the Rings, you know, Tolkien was an Anglo-Saxon scholar. He had such a love for his heritage that it was a game for himself when he wrote The Hobbit. It was just pure fun. But since he had such a genuine love and passion for the subject matter, for heritage and for myth, and he viewed myth, this is a difference a little bit with also Le Guin's take, myth for Tolkien or one of our guys is an organic outreach of culture, is an organic outreach of embodied experience and ethnos, right? Lord of the Rings would not exist. I mean, my God, he takes half the names of the dwarves from like the sagas, you know, like Oakenshield and stuff like this, right? It is an embodiment of his love of tradition, and like Odysseus and like Homer, like Ovid, all the classic poets who remixed all their heritage and oral traditions and remixed it again and again and again. You know, it was a taking something you inherited, myth is internal. And with Le Guin, she treats him more like an artificial construction. She even says that the world is constructed. You have to realize that you can't rely on history or like a shared like culture. Each word, she basically says each word in a fantasy world as spoken is kind of exposition in its own right. Because you can't rely on shared history. You can't rely on shared information. At world building, every time a character speaks is itself an act of world building in a proper quote-unquote fantasy writing, which I agree with. I think that's true. And that's why she thinks it's so crash. And she's not against unrealistic, quote-unquote unrealistic dialogue, because she quotes from Dempsey, I believe.
She's very in favor of unrealistic dialogue that's done sincerely, that doesn't undercut itself consistently. Quipping or you know, very silly anachronisms.
Yes, that's, and also that's very sensory, that's not fake, right? Because she quotes this guy who's deeply flowery. It's very costume ball, like she admits it's very costume ball dialogue. It's about like a bunch of kingsmen trying to sneak their king's body down to a river, but they talk about how his king's toes were peeking up toward the wind and the river was winding, and it's a great section.
So this is that is from let's see here, the Worm Ouroboros. Let me see. By E.R. Edison. So it goes, "The lords of Witchland took their weapons, and the men-at-arms bare the goods. And the king went in the midst of his byre of spear shafts. So went they picking their way in the moonless night round the palace and down the winding path that led to the bed of the combe, and so by the stream westward towards the sea. Here they deemed it safe to light a torch to show them the way. Desolate and bleak showed the sides of the comb in the wind-blown flare, and the flare was thrown back from the jewels of the royal crown of Witchland, and from the armored buskins on the king's feet, showing stark with toes pointing upward from below his bearskin mantle, and from the armor and the weapons of them that bare him and walked beside him, and from the black cold surface of the little river hurrying forever over its bed of boulders to the sea. The path was rugged and stony, and they fared slowly, lest they should stumble and drop the king."
Beautiful. See, it's such a bang. The toes really pull it together, unironically, by the way. It's a beautifully detailed, ornate, right? But it is performative.
Sure.
But it's naturally performative because the author, she notes this. It is performative. It is quote-unquote fake. It's not natural dialogue, but he does it so beautifully, performs it very well. He's naturally performative.
He's distilling a bloodline of experience and a bloodline of linguistic tradition into a very fine shape. Like, even like the line, "so went they," like just those three words alone, like is like so distinguished from any contemporary writer, like the way they would phrase that sentence. And he does that consistently line by line by line by line. And it's why I finally agree with her main argument. And I always love her essays on this kind of stuff, because she is so like the style and I would also add like the POV, like is the story, like the story in this case, like if you put this, the line cap you just read very well in bland third limited, I don't even say George R. R. Martin, because I think he does write well for what he does.
Yeah.
But if you just put it in this like bland third limited, it would like that anyone could write, or anyone could write in like 2 minutes and just pound out.
Yeah.
It would be completely.
They walk carefully along the stream, you know, making slow going because of the uneven terrain. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Soul versus soulless. Yeah. Right. It's it's conveying like the little like details are unnecessary. Like I said, the toes, the winding river, you know, like it is a very fine tightrope though. Yes. Something like this in fantasy that does this, it can come off so clunky. Right. She even noticed that it is a tightrope performance. But I forgot the name of the author, E.R.R. Reno or something like that. Or I forget the author's name.
E.R. Edison.
But E.R. Edison. Edison plays a very tightrope with it, and he does it excellently. He performs it beautifully, right? Because it is a performative language, because this is not how actual medieval people talked. I mean, read Canterbury Tales, for God's sake. They can't even spell knight properly, right? Or even Shakespeare. It is a kind of a word association game of the meme of like early English, or the meme of our Arthurian chivalry era fantasy, right? But he sells you on it, right? A good salesman can sell anything, complete gibberish, if the way he conveys that information to you makes a connection, it hits you in the nerve. You believe these men, you believe the winding rivers, you can feel the rivers, you can feel the stony surface beneath your toes. And I think overall, that's her point overall, is that it is a fundamentally, oddly enough, a reactionary piece at the end of the day, because she's trying to appeal to this idea of you make a distinction between Poughkeepsie and distinction between Elfland. Elfland is harder to do. And it is harder to do, but if done better, final line of this essay, I believe, fantasy can be realer than real, right? It can be better than the real thing, in a sense, because it's so finely constructed, right? It's the idea of the natural dialogue. You know, Andy Sorkin dialogue, who has always claimed to have natural dialogue, even though that's bullshit, right? No dialogue bounces that well, but it's like almost a pornography of what dialogue should be, the platonic ideal of conversations. Or same thing with Tarantino, how he writes dialogue. With fantasy, it's the platonic ideal. Because she even uses the word vitalism. She's like, every word has meaning.
Like, yeah, even specifically uses the word vitalism. Yeah, this, I mean...
Yes, literally vitalism.
This speech is really like... fantastic for the times we currently find ourselves in. Le Guin was ahead of her time and of her time in certain ways, but
and it's that of her time. And I love this essay. I actually really had fun with this essay. And the next essay after this, Why Americans Are Scared of Dragons, it was... However, there's two lines that I felt were off.
Sure.
Were my biggest critique. Which were... Hold on. I got the digital one. Let's see. It was... She complains... Okay, so... there are infinitely worse examples I could have used. I choose this one because in this book, something good has gone wrong. Something real, notice she loves the idea of real, has been falsified. There could be no use at all in talking what is generally passed off as quote-unquote heroic fantasy, with all the endless barbarians of names like Barp and Claude and the Tarnsmen and the Clansmen and all of the rest of them. There'd be nothing whatever to say, and here's the parentheses. Not in terms of art, that is, semicolon. In terms of ethics... racism, sexism, and politics, there'd be a great deal to say.
Right.
Right. So this is probably the first.
Also, yeah. Shout out to John. Well, like call out actually. Call out to John Norman. So.
Torrance and Bros.
We'll never recover.
No, dude. I copy pasted that because I didn't know what she was referring to. And it auto-corrected to trans men, by the way.
Oh, of course it did. Yeah. Mm. The trans men of gore. Sorry. Ooh, you're still a natural slave.
Always have and always will, yeah. Right? So, obviously, this triggered my Carl Schmidtian, politics brain, is that she's basically saying, okay, you have Lovecraft Country, and you have, I think she was a Berkeley professor, Berkeley Fields is land of political, and you have your art, and you're allowed to have your art, you're allowed to have your Lovecraft Country, and you're allowed to play in it, but you can analyze it. Berkeley Fields can take their little telescope and look into Lovecraft Country and commentate. She is doing the classic separating art from politics in this scene.
I think she was more just saying you could discuss the concepts relative to that. And again, I'm not saying I agree with her or her interpretations of sexism, racism, blah blah blah.
Well, but if we had to filter on that basis, we wouldn't be reading her. So,
yeah,
the revealed preference is that we don't. Yeah,
it's just I'm not criticizing that point from a reactionary standpoint. I'm saying even from the piece itself, it kind of contradicts. So, what is sovereign here? Because that's she says
there's a difference between having the ability to comment on your thoughts on something and saying it shouldn't exist or making any statement that severe. I feel like she's not being that severe or that she would not be that severe.
True. With just that comment, it could survive. But I like to contrast just two more points. So this is where her best point comes by.
Former friend of the show, Ursula Le Guin.
former friend, former art ho of the show, Ursula Le Guin.
Let's get that Elaine Art Ho edit of Ursula. Mm. Let's get that up, Jamie.
Let's get the Pog edit. All right, but this is probably the best quote of the piece. Many readers, many critics, and most editors speak of style as if it were an ingredient of a book. Like sugar in a cake, or something added onto the book, like the frosting on the cake. The style, of course, is the book. If you remove the cake, all you have left is a recipe. If you remove the style, all you have left is a synopsis of the plot. This is partly true of history, largely true of fiction, and absolutely true of fantasy. Right, so she says the ultimate sovereignty of fantasy is the style. Right, because the fantasy is a completely fake world. It's absolutely created. And oddly enough, your dedication to making that world feel real is doubly so than that of like a Poughkeepsie writing of pseudo-realist Washington D.C. I think she even calls it Washington D.C. writing. You have to make it twice more realistic than the actual real thing itself to make it believable, because you can't rely on shared customs or shared history. And now this is the final paragraph of the piece, which is also a great ending paragraph. And lastly, I believe that the reader has a responsibility. If we love the stuff we read, we have a duty towards it. The duty is to refuse to be fooled, to refuse to permit commercial exploitation of the holy ground of myth, to reject shoddy work, and to save our praises for the real thing. Because when fantasy is the real thing, nothing, after all, is realer. Right? That's a great ending, paragraph. I think we would all agree with this. Right? To permit no fakery. Obviously, the ultimate form of fakery is enchantment, and you should never let your fakery be debased by crass fakery. Right? It's a great line. It's a great message. Now, however, I like footnotes. I'm a David Foster Wallace guy. Of course, I like footnotes. And if you go to footnote number 3, now this essay was published in, I believe, in 1978?
Yeah, it was the 70s.
73.
Yeah.
Now, however, in the updated version in 1989, this is what she has to say about her previous line about you should separate your fantasy, your art, from the idea of political lens. Quote, I don't find it easy, as I did in 1973, to separate art from ethics, racism, sexism, and politics. This is the contradictory line here. A dangerous...
Gabe is hijacking this completely.
Yes, a dangerous, usually illusory... She has the balls. The gambits? What's the female version of balls? Gambits? She has the gambits.
Ovaries.
Yeah.
The flaps?
No, it's the thing within ovaries. It's gambits, right?
Balls are... No. Gametes are
external organs.
Gametes are eggs and sperm. Those are gametes.
Oh yeah, she has the eggs part. So she has the eggs. To honorably use
the word illusory. Balls. The testes, the balls. The analogous structure in women is ovaries. The thing that contains. I feel like I'm on crazy pills right now.
Waffle bros, I feel the debate coming on.
She has the oval-shaped ovaries, to use the word illusory or illusion.
Illusory.
To critique. Like, you have, look at the final fucking
paragraph. I actually agree with her, though. I don't think arts can be separated from ethics.
Well, then the style is no longer
completely.
Sovereign.
Not electoral, like cringe, but I think, I mean, fundamentally, like what we're doing, art and politics do have some kind of alignment, like the way we view things.
Yeah, it's not entirely it's not entirely possible to separate them. That's absolutely true. Like, because true fiction, this transcendently true fiction that she's talking about and that, you know, I think all of us like to read, is inherently shapes or reflects or focuses a worldview, right? And that has consequences. If you read nothing but stuff that is fake and gay, like, you will not be able to comprehend a world that is otherwise. I mean, that's why dissident publications exist.
Yeah, there are value propositions in the type of the way things are written, and so we may be on different sides of the fence, but I don't think she's crazy for saying that there's a connection there. And I don't know.
She's definitely on the other side of the fence there. Don't get me wrong. But
this is not me critiquing an enemy or a partisan here. I'm saying within the text itself, it seems like she's making a fundamentally modernist point, you know, like a stylistic work as itself, as an aesthetic piece. She's making a high modernist point.
Totally disagree.
You don't think
her argument? No. I'm going back to friend of the show, Michael Lindsay, A Living Religion. Like, the writing style, the way she's discussing it is, like, to be believable, it has to lie and persuade the reader who's willingly indulging this lie that they are participating in the voice, in the point of view, in the, what's the term she uses? The style. In the style that this is a real thing. This is a consistent thing. I was recently rereading The Great Gatsby, and like, it masterfully presents this sort of like melancholy Midwestern guy in, you know, talking about a sort of a past time that's been lost. And like, that wasn't exactly the guy who was writing it, as I understand. Like, he was pretty young at the time, actually, when he was writing it.
F. Scott Fitzgerald?
The old little Cock Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
He was quite young when he wrote that. But he masterfully presents that voice so that you believe it. What's another, Book of the New Sun, another one of my personal favorites in terms of like voice presentation. Mm-hmm. Like, it's completely masterful in the way it presents this false setting that the POV is completely familiar with, you're alien to, but it's done in a way that it creates this. It has a value set to it. It has a complete like master of tone. It's not coming out of nowhere. It's not modernist in the way it's like, it's all a lie, LMAO. It's, I don't know. I'm struggling for the exact word. It's pulling together a tradition, and it's a lived tradition, and it's making you believe that the speaker is presenting this lived tradition to you through really careful word selection, aka diction, sentence structure, like we had in the last example with the king of, what was it, the worm, Ouroboros,
king with of the Witchland.
And so they went picking. And some of these other like weird turns of phrase are, like, that a modern person wouldn't use, that a pirate wouldn't use, that a Chinese immigrant wouldn't use from 1960, that a, you know, there's all these different voices you can adopt. And that is, when she's talking about style, that's what she's talking about. She's talking about either a real lived tradition or a totally false lived tradition that you've generated so compellingly that someone's like, you know, I know it's a lie, but I want to participate because it seems fun and it seems consistent. And so to me, that is like, that's not a modernist interpretation. That's a, regardless of what she thinks, I don't know what her opinion would be, but it's a very classical view of the spirit of a culture, the spirit of a value, of values.
And I agree that's part of her point, and I that is definitely the part of the main text. The reason why I have such a problem with it is like it's like her example of the characters literally looking at the reader and winking and saying, "We're just like you. We're quipping. We're breaking the fourth wall." You know, footnotes are breaking the fourth wall. So, and the footnotes are even revelatory in this, right? It's just that one where she makes that statement, a very big statement. She context on the most political aspect of the text, which is where she makes, there's Elfland and Poughkeepsie, right? Politics, you can have fun in your fantasy land, but you can separate the two. The main text makes the argument you can separate the two, you can commentate on one, but there is such thing as separating the two. But she made it a point 16 years later to use the word dangerous and illusory. From her POV, and just, I don't know anything about this woman. I know her grandfather, her father worked with Franz Boas, the American of Anthropology, a little bit. I didn't do that much background checking. It's not Gabe being basically kind of like, the right-wing Twitter bro, like, critiquing it from, like, I'm not being Twitter-brained here. It's just the text itself seems to be contradicting each other. Like, what does she want me to take from this? Is style most important? But then she says, if I focus just on style or the art, is it dangerous? Is it, dare I say, illusory? Right? Using that word illusory, I thought was very comical.
I don't see style and art as exactly the same thing in this situation, though.
Yeah,
we can agree to disagree. That's fine too.
And again, it's a good, and then again, it actually is a really great essay. Like the beginning paragraph where she talks about all the people going to Yosemite and then going to Yellowstone, right? But they all bring their radios and their grills, and they're all absorbed in secondhand experiences, right? Until they have the firsthand experience of a bear, you know. It's a very, that paragraph was actually, oddly enough, a very reactionary paragraph. It reminds me of Horace's favorite saying, you know, no matter how much you try to drive away nature with a pitchfork, she always comes roaring back.
And yeah. Well, do you think Yosemite Sam is Jewish?
Well, you can't spell Yosemite without Semite, right?
All right. We may have hijacked your topic. By we, I mean Gabe.
It was too good of a topic. I actually generally did like chewing on this essay. I took notes on it for real. Well, Cap, what was your take on the political angle of it?
I glossed that because it was not the. I said that I do understand that it's not entirely separable, really. But yeah, I mean the. To the degree that it's mentioned in this piece from Le Guin, which it isn't really, I didn't care. Other than that, she did call out my man John Norman. Women are slaves,
and also she subtly references Conan, by the way, with the barbarian part.
Well, she just mentions all of the heroic fantasy, which I mean, yeah, like Edgar Rice Burroughs and John Norman and, you know,
Mr. Howard
John Howard, or not John Howard, Robert E. Howard.
John Howard.
They're all Johns. You ever notice how they're all Johns? Everyone's named John.
John was my father.
What do you think about that, John Gabe? What do you think about that, John David?
John Harrod, actually.
I'm just sick of them
been.
Adding water that adding things to the water that turns everyone into Johns.
Actually, it's Jerome Harrod. Thank you very much.
Jerome, the metronome. All right, I think that's good on that one.
All right, so my topic, you know, after my beautiful Sydney Sweet, Sydney Sweeney's tits are anti-woke, was shot down, was based on Han's piece, actually, ARX Han, good friend of the show, you know, an honorable Chinaman. We're all science fiction authors now, which kind of actually goes with both David's point and, oddly enough, Cap's point. Because this essay, this excellent essay on Substack, basically says technology is intruding upon our lives to such a degree that even you're trying to do a classic Raymond Carver slice of life dialogue or slice of life, you know, piece, fundamentally technology is accelerating to such a degree that technology can no longer be absent from the piece. You know, much like how Bret Easton Ellis would talk about how, you know, the proper way to actually talk about being a teenager in the 1970s and 80s was to bring up bands. You know, you can't have the timeless novel or the timeless setting anymore. To properly, you know, relay life, one, the modernist conception, the style I approved of, the style I was taught, the Nabokovian style, has been completely fucking killed. Right? The novel, treating the novel as itself, judging it based on the novel on its own merits is dead. Writing is only successful, and writing will only continue to even exist as an extension of persona-based writing. Persona-based writing and even mimetic-based writing. Memes and basically, you know, e-celebs. Basically, that's the future of writing. You know, no longer will you judge a writing based on how good the prose is, but whether or not you like the guy's takes on Twitter. And the fact that writing is now no longer a solitary act, but rather an extension of technology creeping into our lives, and us reviewing people only through an extension of a simulacrated experience. Because it's an extension of both David's point about the idea of basically manufacturing a self-licking ice cream cone maximum of basically these boomer white guys in their 30s and 40s who publish just 100 books a year just to say that they can, and through algorithm glitching, or basically like the boomers in Vegas who just constantly slam on the penny slots. There's really no difference between that and the guys who, you know, like, let's just say Narc Lawson, you know, who publish 100 books a year, and then they end up buying their own books in bulk just so they can be on a bestsellers list, right? It's no different from the boomers playing on the penny slots. And you see this to such a radical degree. And I think Han is right when he says that Twitter is a horrible place for authors now. Because at the end of the day, reading as a pastime, no one reads just to read anymore, right? We are taught this way. You and I and Cap, we liked reading since a young age, and we generally like to read, right? But in terms of us interacting with people, we are mimetic. For God's sake, we can't even review Chamberlain without making references to Wojaks and memes, and constantly trying to bring Chamberlain like a shaman and resurrecting his ghost and his image and his persona into a right-wing dissident meme culture, right? That's how we market this man to our audience, right? And that's how we have to, because that's the only way we know how to communicate. You know, a person who grew up in meme culture, like Wittgenstein's Lion, we can only communicate in a way people who have been exposed to a meme culture can communicate. So this classical idea of modernism, or our idea of literature, which is literature based on its own merits, is fundamentally dead, and that writing can only be judged, and writing can only persevere as an extension of e-celebs and their personas.
Yeah, I do actually remember that now, and I disagree with it, actually, that I think to define us as uniquely meme-worthy, I think is unfair. Not even us, I mean us moderns. I think it's just the methods of distribution have changed. So, you know, e-celeb status, it sells books, but 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it was a publishing house. 1,000 years ago, it was your messaging, you know, Christianity messaging favorably, or maybe the Roman Emperor being favorable to the Roman Emperor. I think ultimately human communication on any large scale is largely meme-based. You know, it's not literal memes. It's not a Wojak, but it's based on common tribally accepted conceptions of like what is good and what is bad, you know, shared repeated imagery and stories and ideas. Like, I guess I disagree with his take in a few ways. One that we're in a unique of a spot in that way. I think the cult of the personality also, I think he undersells how much historically there's always been a cult of personality to the author. Like, you look at any author that was famous while they were alive, and they did cater to that. I don't know. So I guess I disagreed largely with Han on this one, and his I always say techno-utopian, his techno-optimist, because he's not an optimist, but what I would refer to as an energy-blind point of view, that this is like going to perpetually keep growing, and that we're not like already past the zenith of this kind of market mindset, and now we're in the like maybe a slow decline of it. I don't know. I wasn't persuaded personally for those reasons.
Well, the reason why I found it pseudo persuasive was that if you notice, everything is decentralized. Marketing is decentralized. At least with public, the good thing about a publishing house is there was a sense of judgment. You know why? A publishing agent who had a reputation, who was a good judge of character, could tell you had talent. You know, can swoop you up, pick you up, and market you, right? With the decentralization, it's the difference between the algorithm showing you cat videos versus a person of taste and quality and actually curation. The idea of curation and manicuring is gathering talent like a botanist rather than as a pimp. You know,
a lot of that is historical bias, though. What's the magic word Prude used in our episode? Not modernism, presentism. Yeah. It's a presentism of, it's not even the right term for it, but you're applying a century of refinement of evaluations of past art onto. So you're talking about Ezra Pound's selections, but in terms of like who was most widely read, like if you look at the most widely read reading material in any particular year, it probably is not people you'd even recognize, right? So it's not necessarily that like even the people back then, the publishers were putting out their best, or what we would consider the best, which is probably biased by the education system that identifies and indoctrinates us in what is good, right? Like, would any of us have just found Hemingway on our own? I very much doubt if you were just thrown out into the wild with all the books in the world, you would have said, oh yeah, Hemingway, he's one of the big ones. That would be needle in a haystack. But you know, through this is sort of historical filtered lens, they're put forward in this way. But I don't know, in the time, in the year, there was like Weird Tales is a perfect example. Weird Tales, when it was out, I think was like not even the top in its little subgenre, and then it eventually failed. You know, floundered, stopped paying people, and failed while it was still putting out Howard before he killed himself. Like, they were still putting out what's now sells for a fortune, and they couldn't even pay their top talent, what now we recognize as like, you know, a god of pulp writers. But in the era, you know, but what was selling, you know, Zip Zoodle Weekly, I'm just making that name up, but there was like some other ones that were selling better. And so I guess that's another reason I don't agree with his perspective that there was this quality control then that we're missing now. I think it has changed. It's become more level in a way, and that's created more chaos, but I don't think it's nearly as dramatic as many people like to portray it.
Well, I mean, what would you rather have? Let's say the year is 1996, before quote-unquote wokeness. Would you rather try to market like on whatever 1996 version of Twitter is, decentralized, and, you know, in Providence? Or would you rather take your shot in trying to publish in Providence with a good agent who will actually take you, mold you, and you officially be in an actual clique under a patronage? and actually have a sense of actually a systemic way to deal with things.
I'm not sure I follow. Would I rather have an agent or not? Is that the question?
No. You have a patronage network, people who groom you, of an actual established system of patronage.
I mean, this is a pro-groomer program, so yeah, I'm going to be groomed.
All right. Well, Cap, you're the tiebreaker. Well, what's your thoughts on the piece?
Yeah, I mean, I would rather be plugged into the ecosystem for sure. It's just more beneficial.
Oh, so you're actually choosing against decentralization to be more of the patronage style.
Yeah, I mean,
well, it's like if you're offering a seat at the table,
then I mean, yeah. I mean, if all else being equal, yeah, the logistics network, go for it.
Because yet again, well, it's the idea of quality. It's why guilds were invented, right? It's the idea of fellow tradesmen.
Guilds were to reduce competition and like completely control, have monopolized control of a resource in a small territory. So that, well, that wasn't about quality. Listen, completely.
That's what the free market liberals will tell you. All right. Yeah. It's like Darth Plagueis the Wise. You know, you haven't heard a true protectionist argument for guilds, why guilds are based. Well, a proper guild is molding a community. It's molding the idea. Like, Ezra Pound's clique in 1920s France was a sort of guild, right? Because Ezra Pound had his own sense of talent and a knack for talent, right? Yet again, it's the pornographic high time preference of the cat video or David Spelunky's top 100 pulp tales of crime fiction, blondes getting their nipples torn off by the teeth versus James Joyce. Right, versus Joyce, right, who was basically a hyper autistic fart fetishist, right? But
he did Ezra Pound, he did love his dirty little fuck bird.
Yes, but he lived his dirty little fuck bird, and he managed to write a hyper lit cell novel about his dirty little fuck bird, right, in the form of Ulysses. So I agree that decentralized is the idea of the structures of a patronage network, the woke, you know, whatever. Like, that's what we are. That's what we're, a makeshift patronage network. What our platonic job is as a podcast, as reviewers, our platonic job is to do what Ezra Pound did, to see the potential Ezra Pound's.
I agree. I don't want to be a shot caller. I don't want to be the. Someone else who I won't even say who, but like one of the people we reviewed referred to us like that because we reviewed their book positively, and I appreciate the vote of confidence, but I don't see that as our role, and I don't want to be trying to pretend that I have any kind of power over that. I see it as we're like making ourselves a little sub-click. We're offering meaningful criticism, thought, compliments that are hopefully like are obviously very genuine
and criticism that's productive.
Yeah, productive. Yeah, we're not going to shit on anyone that we think is total garbage. We're just not going to. If we review your book, it's because we actually think there's something good there. We're not going to just dump on, except for people that cut their dad's heads off. We will just shit on you.
I mean, he did have some else. There was more good in The Punishing than I thought there was going to be.
Yes, we were actually very even-handed, and yet again with his alleged crimes, yes, of cutting his own father's head off. Actually, yet again, there has been no final verdict in that particular matter.
No, good, that was a good one, Gabe. And so, yeah, this is, thank you everyone that listened. Please drop us a review; much appreciated if you do. And please consider checking out our brand spanking new, our Subscribestar and Patreon if you're in the giving mood. We super appreciate it and look forward to hearing from you if you're one of our big dog, big tuggers that sign up there. And yeah, with that, thank you for listening. Have a good night.
Cheers.